Good evening, everyone. Welcome to St. Mary's University, and I thank you for joining us for the Lynn Great Speakers series. My name is Andre Hampton, and I'm the Provost and Academic Vice President for St. Mary's University. I welcome all of you who have come to join us for this, our second Lynn Great Speaker presentation of the 2012-2013 academic year. And I'm delighted to see so many here from the faculty and the staff and the students at the university in the audience. The Lynn Speaker Series, which was begun in 1990, is made possible by an endowment established in the memory of Xu Shi Lin by his widow, Mrs. Chang Li Chao Lin, and his son, our alum, Vincent Lin, PhD. The series is presented to the public as a community service, and for 20 years, St. Mary's has invited visionaries from all fields to speak to our university community and to the larger San Antonio community. And I welcome all of you who are here from the larger San Antonio community. It gives me great pleasure to introduce our speaker tonight, Mr. E.J. Dion. Mr. Dion is a nationally known and respected commentator on politics. He appears weekly on the National Public Radio and regularly on MSNBC. He is a regular contributor to NBC's Meet the Press, and he has also appeared on NewsHour with Jim Blair and other PBS programs. Mr. Dion's career has included positions with the New York Times and the Washington Post. He has several best-selling books to his credit, including Why Americans Hate Politics, which Newsday called a classic in American political history, which also won the Los Angeles Times Book Prize and was a National Book Award nominee. Mr. Dion has received numerous awards, including the American Political Science Association's Kerry McWilliams Award to honor a major journalistic contribution to the understanding of politics. He has been named among the 25 most influential Washington journalists by the National Journal and among the capital city's top 50 journalists by Washington Magazine. He was elected as a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Other awards include the Empathy Award from the Volunteers of America, the National Human Services Assemblies Award for Excellence, and the Sidney Hillman Foundation Award for Career Achievement. Now, this year at St. Mary's, the focus of our Lynn Speaker Series is Educating for Adaptation and Change. As you may know, Education for Adaptation and Change is one of the five characteristics of Marianist education. And we chose this topic because the nation in 2012 was on the verge of a very important moment in our time, the 2012 election. And plus, we had heard there were many changes going on around the world and in the country. Everyone is looking towards the future. However, in his latest book, Our Divided Political Heart, Mr. Dion invites us to explore our political and social history as a way to gain valuable insight about how to bridge the differences that threaten our ability as a society to adapt to a changing world. Now, at the conclusion of Mr. Dion's speech, there will be a brief question and answer session, so keep that in mind. At this time, I'd like us to give him a very, very warm St. Mary's and San Antonio welcome.
Thank you all. Thank you so much for that very, very warm introduction. It was so much nicer than an introduction I once received that ended, "You didn't mean it this way." And now, for the latest dope from Washington, here's E.J. Dionne. So thank you very, very much. It is, I got to say, a real, real joy to be in San Antonio. This is a place I've been very fortunate because of the work I do to be able to travel all over the country, and I have never gotten to come to San Antonio. So I want to thank St. Mary's for not only having me to St. Mary's, but also bringing me to San Antonio, which is as wonderful a city as I always imagined it. I spent a wonderful day here today. You also helped me do some work for my column. I interviewed your very interesting mayor before I came over here. I really love your city, and I want to thank you all for coming out tonight. I've always loved Texas politics. You can't not love Texas politics. I mean, truth is, I love politics almost wherever it is. You know, I was friendly with and actually worked with Molly Ivins in her brief sojourn away from Texas. Molly was so full of so many wonderful lines. The one I was thinking of tonight is, "If you took all the fools out of the legislature, it would no longer be a representative body," which I think applies to many legislators. Also, your great Ann Richards, who was one of the funniest, had one of the greatest senses of humor in politics. I remember once, it was during a period when oil prices were spiking, which isn't so bad for Texas, but still not good for people at the pump. And Ann Richards once said that oil prices have gotten so high that women have had to carpool to run over their husbands. It's a very Ann Richards to say. It was also very nice, you know, nationally respected commentator. That sounds like a contradiction in terms. I mean, a lot of people view political pundits, as somebody once said this, as they come in after the battle and shoot the wounded. I just have to say one other thing is my wife is named Mary, and she's sainted, so I told her I was speaking tonight at a place named after her. But I do love the Blessed Mother, and I have all my life been looking for a church called Our Lady of Perpetual Indulgence, which we all need a great deal of. But, we pundits and commentators, you know, are seen by a lot of people as fairly arrogant. Indeed, we are seen as working pretty hard at it. But you should know that thanks to new technology, there are forces keeping us humble. I don't know if you ever look at those comments underneath our columns. They're not very kind. I recently actually wrote a column. It would have been my late mom's 100th birthday on February 8th. And it actually allowed me to say that there was one issue on which I deeply agreed with your former governor, our former president, George W. Bush. He married a teacher and a librarian, and my late mom was a teacher and a librarian. And I just wrote this column about my mom and how important she was to me. I'd sent it to my sister to make sure my sister wanted to make sure I didn't miss anything or get any family history wrong. And the next day, my column appears, and my sister was looking it up to send to some old friends, and there were all these nasty comments under a column about my mother, and my sister was very upset. And I said to her, you know, "Don't worry, they're not talking about mom, they're talking about me." But that's the way the world is now. And one of my very favorites, because it was more polite than some of them, it was an email I got from a reader, this is true, and it said, "Dear Mr. Dionne, are you as dumb in person?" And I always like to quote that in talks, because if you get nothing else out of this talk, you'll be able to answer that question for yourself. So you can let me know at the end. I am from Massachusetts. That's where I grew up. And Mary McGrory, my dear colleague at the Washington Post, once said that every baby born in Massachusetts is born with a campaign manager's gene. We also in Massachusetts don't always have politics on the level. The great story out of Massachusetts politics is of a gentleman in a town called Springfield, Massachusetts, which you should know is about 70 miles from Boston. He was preparing his will, and You know, his lawyer was going over his will, and everything made sense, except he asked to be buried in a particular cemetery in Boston, 70 miles away. The cemetery happened to be located, something you're familiar with in Texas, in a cemetery happened to be located in the district of a state senator well known for turning out 120% of the vote, if that was what was needed. And so the lawyer said, I don't get it. Why do you want to be buried 70 miles from where you grew up? And he looked at the lawyer and he said, because I see no reason why my death should deprive me of my right to participate in the democratic process. And just two other political stories I love. One is, if I ever get depressed about politics not being on the level in Massachusetts, and you can do the same, I think of Louisiana. Anybody here from Louisiana, I love Louisiana politics. There was a great character in Louisiana politics called Edwin Edwards. You may remember him. He eventually ended up in the Slammer. But he was a fascinating, very funny man, and he had a lot of self-knowledge, and he knew the voters in the state knew that he wasn't always on the level, and he was running to try to get back into office against a Republican incumbent when the unemployment rate was up at 11%. He went all over the state and said, if you reelect my opponent, there'll be nothing left for me to steal. And he kept the promise. He brought the economy back, and he continued to steal. The other thing he said, this one you should save up for a particular occasion. He said of this opponent, my opponent is so dumb that it takes him 2 hours to watch 60 Minutes. That one works in a lot of occasions. Last political story, which actually goes to the theme of what I want to talk about tonight, is a Massachusetts story about a governor called Christian Herter. He was later Dwight Eisenhower's Secretary of State. And the story is of Governor Herter is told that it was the end of a very long, difficult campaign day. He was really tired and really hungry, and he went to a barbecue, a campaign barbecue. We have those in Massachusetts, even if they're not authentic the way they are down here. And the lady's in line and gives him one piece of chicken. And he says, you know, I'm really hungry. Can you give me another piece of chicken? And the lady said, nope, you know, I'm really worried that we're not going to have enough chicken to go around. I can only give you one piece of chicken. And he goes back and forth. And finally, and apparently Herter wasn't like this, but he was really tired. And he says, do you know who I am? I am the governor of Massachusetts. And the lady looks at him and says, do you know who I am? And he says, no. She says, I am the lady in charge of the chicken. And I would like to say that in a lot of ways, my talk tonight is dedicated to that lady in charge of the chicken and every other lady and person in charge of the chicken and everybody who doesn't like it when other people try to throw their weight around. And I think that's very much who we are as Americans. So I'm going to talk a little bit about my book tonight, which really grows out of the idea that we Americans are a very confusing people, and perhaps especially confusing to ourselves. The self-portraits we paint are often contradictory. Our movies, our music, our literature all seem to celebrate conflicting values. Is our country better personified by the community-loving Jimmy Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life, or by the rogue individualism of Clint Eastwood in Dirty Harry? I'm talking about the Dirty Harry Clint Eastwood, not the guy with the chair. Or does Woody Guthrie's This Land Is Your Land or Frank Sinatra's My Way speak more to who we are? Is our experiment unique because it recognizes the importance of solidarity illustrated in John Steinbeck's novels, or it because it celebrates the sanctity of independence celebrated by Jack Kerouac? Our divided political heart grew out of my love for this American story of ours and its contradictions. It argues that there is a classic American balance between individualism and community, between government and the market, between the public and the private. It is ultimately an optimistic book about a very difficult time because I think our continuing efforts to get this balance right, especially at moments when we don't seem to be getting it right, have usually worked out in the end. I never tire of quoting my favorite line about us as Americans. Many of you have probably heard this. It's Winston Churchill's line that Americans can always be counted on to do the right thing after they have first exhausted all of the other possibilities. We often don't get things right in the first place, but eventually we get there. So what do I mean by our divided political heart? I am talking about the fact that from the very beginning, Americans have been torn by a deep but healthy tension between our love of individualism and our affection for community. Too often, especially in recent years, I think we have told our story almost entirely on the individualistic side. We have emphasized individual liberty to the exclusion of our dedication to community and equality. We have not focused enough on how the liberty we prize depends upon our willingness to come to the defense of each other's liberty, how liberty depends upon strong communities, energetic government, and a concern for the common good. I should say that my book in many ways was inspired by the Tea Party. It picks an argument with the Tea Party, which I will get to. But I also think that the Tea Party was right to go back to the origins of our country and to start an argument about who we are. And I think one of the reasons we can't agree on who we are is because we can't agree on who we've been. If the Tea Party was right to go back to the origins, I think those of us who are progressive have been too willing to leave the argument about American history to our friends on the right. We have been too reluctant to embrace the American story, which I believe in so many ways is a progressive story. Should our conservative friends be the only people who carry around constitutions, copies of the Constitution in their pockets, or to quote it? Why should we leave quoting the Federalist to them? Why leave the Declaration to them? The most forward-looking politicians and moral spokespeople in our history didn't do that. If you go back to Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, it drew its inspiration from the promises of that Declaration of Independence. The entire beginning of the speech is built around the Declaration. And he spoke of it as a promissory note that had been given to African Americans that had come back stamped unpaid insufficient funds. It was a very powerful way to make his case, and it was a case rooted right squarely in the American story. Consider the first word of the Constitution of the United States. I'm asking to think about community and the common good. So what is the first word of the Constitution of the United States?
We.
Exactly. Say it again.
We.
Yes. I love hearing American crowds saying we. We don't say it often enough. It's we. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare. Yes, welfare is right there in the first paragraph of the Constitution of the United States. And secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Again, ourselves and our posterity, not me and mine, do ordain and establish this Constitution. The Declaration is a perfect reflection of the balance between individualism and community. It begins by describing the unalienable rights that come from our Creator to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But in the very last paragraph of the Declaration, the founders pledge their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. They understood that we cannot protect individual liberty unless we act together. I wanted to quote something from the Declaration that's in my book, and this gentleman has a copy. Which I forgot to bring my own copy tonight. Could somebody give me a copy of my own book? Thank you. Yeah, guy's so cheap he won't even buy his own book. Let me just find this passage, which I should have marked. But I, you know, I like people to realize that the Declaration of Independence was actually the first negative political ad in American history. When you think about the structure of the Declaration, it has all that great language at the beginning about unalienable rights. But the whole thing is an argument against the king, and it says how sort of rotten the king is and why we decided things are so bad that we're going to start a new country of our own. And a couple of things intrigue me about that list of abuses and usurpations, as our founders call them. First, I'd like to note that taxes don't come up until item number 17 on that list. And when taxes do come up, our founders are not objecting to the idea of taxation. They remonstrated against the crown for imposing taxes on us without our consent. And I'm quoting. They were concerned about consent. That is popular rule, not taxes. The very first item on the list condemned the king because he, quote, refused his assent to laws the most wholesome and necessary for the public good. And the second was just like it. He had forbidden his governors to pass laws of immediate and pressing importance. Our forebears wanted to enact laws. They weren't anti-government zealots. There was, however, one great piece of anti-government rhetoric in the Declaration that I like to quote just because I love the way it sounds. It is, I believe, item number 11. I could have the count wrong, but it's this one. This is the king. He has erected a multitude of new offices and sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. I submit to you that that is a far better attack than anything the Koch brothers came up with during the 2012 election. We have had a parallel argument about government in our history to the one that we've had about individualism in community. I had a lot of fun in the book going back through the legacies of Hamilton and Clay and Abraham Lincoln and later to our progressive and populist legacies. I spent a lot of time with the American Whigs, and some of you may know that I talk and argue about politics with my friend David Brooks on NPR. And when I finished the book, I actually showed up at NPR one day and I said, you know, this whole book was worth writing because I finally discovered why you, David, are completely crosswise to American politics. You are the last living, surviving American Whig. And if you actually read my friend David closely, he really is much more of a Whig than he is a Republican or a Democrat. Why are the Whigs interesting? Well, the Whigs, and Abe Lincoln was a Whig, really believed in a very important role for government in building up our country. They were capitalists. They believed in a market system. They were often seen as allies. Oh, thank you. I'll have to. I had a lot of sympathy for Marco Rubio. You know, we all make that mistake. Thank you for protecting me from it. They believed in a capitalist system, but they believed government had an important role in making it work. In fact, we believed in government for a long time. The first version of socialized medicine in our country was signed into law by President John Adams in 1798. Yes, President John Adams created the Marine Hospital Service, which funded hospitals across the country to treat sailors who were sick or got injured on the job. Now, it makes you want to know what was the powerful sailors' lobby doing back then. But there is absolutely no record of a mass campaign at the time to repeal Adams Care. And I have to tell you, mistakes people make. I had the great fun of being on the Jon Stewart show talking about this book. And instead of referring to sick and injured sailors, fool that I am, I referred to sick and injured seamen. And you can only imagine what Jon Stewart did with that that night. So I have never made that mistake again, but I can't resist telling you the Jon Stewart story. Or take another issue. If you believe the Constitution is absolutely clear and can be read in only one way, then you have to deal with the fact that within 3 years, 3 years of the enactment of the federal Constitution, Alexander Hamilton and James Madison, two of its leading authors, two of its leading interpreters in the Federalists, were at each other's throats over whether the federal government had a right to establish the Bank of the United States. My chapter on the Constitution is called One Nation Conceived in Argument. And I couldn't resist quoting my friend, the legal scholar Garrett Epps, who noted once that Justice Scalia and other originalists seemed to root their jurisprudence in the idea, I knew the founders. The founders were friends of mine. I know how they think. But the Constitution actually grew out, as you all know from your civics books and history lessons, it grew out of a series of compromises, including some we now view as pretty terrible compromises, like the compromise over slavery. It defends competing values, as former Justice David Souter has said. And I think we do ourselves a disservice, and we do the founders a disservice, to think of them as unique or sainted, as people who received our Constitution as if they were, it was a tablet or a set of tablets from the heavens. They were gifted men, and we have reason to be grateful for them. They wrote the most enduring Constitution in the world. But there were also politicians, just like our politicians, who made compromises. They were adventurous. They were embarking on a radical experiment for its time, rooted in the idea that a people could govern themselves, which was not an idea widely accepted in the world. And so I think that to think of our Constitution as a set of shackles designed to keep our country in exactly the same condition it was in 1787 and to prevent us from addressing new problems in new ways does a disservice to the bold and adventurous nature of our founders. Hamilton and Clay thought the Constitution gave wide room for action. Clay called his program the American system. And what's intriguing about it is he called it the American system to distinguish it from the British system, which he said was rooted in laissez-faire economics. Imagine, the American system was the one not rooted in laissez-faire economics because we Americans believed that government had a major role to play in building the country. Clay famously supported a strong federal role in launching internal improvements, which I think sounds so much nicer than the word we use these days, infrastructure. He was talking about the bridges and the canals and the roads that fostered commerce and bound our nation together. Now, I argue that our friends in the Tea Party are not looking back to the entirety of our history, but they're really looking to an exceptional period in our history as typical. It's the one period when radical individualism really was powerful and perhaps even dominant. Only in the period of the Gilded Age, the 35 years after, from the end of the Civil War to the rise of Teddy Roosevelt to the White House, were these ideas really dominant. And they did have an enormous effect. It was in that period that the Supreme Court declared, not before, it was in that period, that the Supreme Court declared that corporations are people. And by the way, on that issue, I think the last word was had by Professor Stephen Colbert. When he heard of this idea that corporations are people, Colbert said, I think I want my daughter to grow up and marry a really nice corporation. It was in that period that the famous Lochner decision was made, which denied the federal government the ability to regulate the hours of workers. And so what I think happened is that these 35 years became the sort of dominant view of what the American story was. But what happened during this period of radical individualism? Well, it immediately called forth a rebellion. The rebellion came first from the populace, and there were a whole lot of those here in Texas, and also from the progressives. And the populace and the progressives said, no, we share with all Americans a mistrust of concentrated power. But I think what's been particular about Americans is that we understand that concentrated power can exist in government, and we fight it when it becomes too strong. But concentrated power can also exist in the private economy. It can exist in monopolies. It can exist when concentrations of wealth get too great. And so the populists and progressives said, we are going to put an end to this Gilded Age. And as I see the story, not create a new era of big government, but return us back to the classic American balance reflected in our founders and in Hamilton, Clay, and Lincoln, my non-sacred trinity for the evening. Herbert Croly, I think, put it very well. He said that Teddy Roosevelt, his idea, which Teddy Roosevelt picked up, was to use Hamiltonian means to serve Jeffersonian ends, that he wanted to use an active federal government to ensure greater equality of opportunity and an economy that would not be dominated by trusts or a very small number of people. Those looking for encouragement in our current debates can go back to some of the things that both Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson said about trusts and concentrated economic power. They sometimes sound like they walked off those old Occupy Wall Street encampments. Wilson at one point warned that the country faced a time, quotes, when the power of high finance would be greater than the power of government. We heard a lot of that more recently. And so if we've sought to strike balances between individualism and community, we've also sought to strike a balance between the state and the market. We have used government to check concentrated economic power, even as we have used constitutional means to check the power of government. How does this translate into now? It seems to me that for really 100 years since Teddy Roosevelt was president, our country operated under a long consensus, and this long consensus accepted and honored a market economy. It honored competition. It honored individual enterprise, but it also saw a major role for government in checking excessive power and also in enhancing opportunity. And this consensus across both political parties. Think back, for example, to the presidency of Dwight Eisenhower. Two of his greatest domestic achievements were the interstate highway system, which was one of the great public works programs well in the tradition of Henry Clay in our country's history, and the National Defense Education Act, which helped send millions of people, including me, to college. It was the beginning of all of our student loan programs. And so Eisenhower kind of ratified the long consensus for the Republican Party. At the risk of offending some of my friends in the room, Richard Nixon continued some of these very things in his own administration. We forget that it was Richard Nixon who signed the bill to create the EPA. It was Richard Nixon who signed the bill to create the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. It was Richard Nixon who signed the bill to index Social Security. This consensus about an effective government helping build the country crisscrossed both parties. And I think we've been having a big fight in our politics since because that consensus has come under attack. And I think there has been a major change within the conservative movement. Now I got to say that although I am unapologetically critical of conservatism in some of its current forms, I actually have great affection for the conservative tradition. I would like to see a time when progressives and conservatives can reason together. And I hope that by pointing out pointing to both sides of our political heart, conservatives and progressives might recognize a bit of themselves in the other. Conservatives do care about community despite their current approaches to politics. They coach sports teams. They coach little leagues. They belong to Rotary clubs. And liberals certainly care passionately about liberty. Where did the American Civil Liberties Union come from? But I think that for now, conservatism has given up on some of its strongest communitarian traditions. They have given up these traditions in favor of a defense of radical individualism, which is, I think, quite different from where conservatives used to be. William F. Buckley Jr., the founder of, in many ways, the founder of modern American conservatism, wrote before he died a book called Gratitude. And it was a book in which Buckley argued that we all have an obligations back to the country that protected us and nurtured us. And I worry very much that if the Bill Buckley, who wrote the book Gratitude, tried to run in a primary these days, he would lose as some kind of socialist for talking about the word gratitude. I can't mention Buckley, by the way, without telling you one favorite Buckley story. I don't know how many people in this room remember a great American, actually, Michael Harrington, who wrote a book called The Other America. It was about America. It really sort of helped a lot of Americans recognize that there were many poor people among us that we had to do something about. And Harrington's book is credited with starting the war, with pushing LBJ and John Kennedy to start the war on poverty. But Mike Harrington was also a socialist. And Buckley, who represented a form of television that I think we need to go back to, which is he believed in real argument among people who took each other seriously, not kind of show trial sort of argument that we've become accustomed to. So Buckley would invite on his show Firing Line people he really respected and liberals he really respected and then have a real argument with them. But Buckley was once on a platform with Harrington to debate him, and the kind gentleman doing the introductions was as kind as the gentleman who introduced me, and he described Michael Harrington as America's leading socialist. And that was, it was right down the middle of the plate for Buckley. Buckley got up and he said, and you remember he had this funny way of talking with his pen, and he said, "America's leading socialist, that would be a bit like being the tallest building in Topeka." Anyway, I like conservatives like that. And so I think we've been going through this fight over the long consensus, and I think we had the argument about the long consensus in the last election. And I'll be happy to talk more about contemporary politics in the Q&A. But I think if you look at the trajectory of the Obama administration, I think that he started out hoping that he could have, you know, put an end to all this partisan rancor. It turned out that we had some really deep differences that we had to fight out. And I think that the key moment was the debt ceiling fight in the summer of 2011, where it left, I think, the president in a much weaker position. And he felt at the end of that, that he had to win an election and fight on first principles rather than go through that all over again, because the Republicans and conservatism in its current form were not willing to make the kind of compromises that preserving the long consensus required. And so he ran his whole campaign on this, what I would argue is this balanced view of government's role in our society. He went to Osawatomie, Kansas, where Teddy Roosevelt had given a great speech on behalf of the ideas of the new nationalism, setting up, in a way, the whole theoretical underpinning of the long consensus. When I was writing this book at the time, and when Obama went to Osawatomie, I said the only person happier than I am that he went to that place Teddy Roosevelt gave the speech was the president of the Osawatomie Chamber of Commerce. But we had a campaign on these subjects, and we had an argument about it, and the 47% was part of that argument, and the makers and takers were part of that argument. And I think that as a country, we was it was a close-run thing, but not all that close. The country decided that on balance it favored this traditional American balance. And I would like to think that over time, it's the way things are working in Washington right now, you would have not known that that election had actually happened. But certain things have happened from it. I think certain reforms will happen from it. And eventually, I think we'll come to terms with the fact that Americans don't want to roll back the long consensus. And so I want to close with this. I want to know how many Bruce Springsteen fans are there in this audience. There are always some good. Yeah, bless you all. I want to close with the following. I want to close with an argument that will show you that Bruce Springsteen has a great deal in common with our American Puritans. Now, this you would never expect to come out to your lecture saying Bruce Springsteen and the Puritans have a lot in common. And I just want to tell you a story that a few weeks before this book was published, a friend who had read an early draft, she was actually my assistant at work, went to see Bruce at a concert. This was, I think, in June of 2012. And she came back in the office the next day and she said, I had to listen to the new Springsteen song that she saw as offering a musical summary of the core themes of the book I had just written. And not only that, she thought that it would be the perfect anthem for President Obama's reelection campaign. Those of you who know the Wrecking Ball album know where this story is going. But first, let me quote The Puritan. It's one of my favorite lines, actually, out of American history. It was actually one of Ronald Reagan's favorite speeches out of American history. You remember that Ronald Reagan used to love to talk about America as a shining city on a hill. Well, that came from a sermon speech by John Winthrop in Massachusetts in 1630, and it was entitled A Model of Christian Charity. And here's one of the lines I really like. Winthrop said, "We must delight in each other, make others' conditions our own, rejoice together, mourn together, labor and suffer together, always having before our eyes our community as members of the same body." I think Rush Limbaugh might see Winthrop as a bit socialistic. Always having before our eyes our community as members of the same body. And, of course, the song from the Wrecking Ball album that those of you who know Springsteen know had the refrain, the key song, had the refrain, "Wherever this flag is flown, we take care of our own." And I think there is a straight line from John Winthrop in 1630 to Bruce Springsteen in 2012. I think that this was the "we take care of our own" election. Those of you who might have been watching President Obama's acceptance speech, the first words you heard after he was finished were Bruce Springsteen singing, "We take care of our own." This is not a radical foreign idea to the United States. This is not an idea that disdains enterprise. This is not an idea that says, no, we're not responsible for ourselves. Of course we are. This is an idea that says that America works best when we look out for each other, that America works best when we build community together. Both Winthrop and Springsteen speak, I think, to some of the very best aspects of what it means to be an American. And I think we will honor our past and build a more just and secure future by remembering, as they do, that building a nation where liberty thrives requires us to stand with each other and make each other's conditions our own. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I always throw in Springsteen because I get a little extra applause from the boss's fans. So bless you all. Thank you very, very much. I love Q&A, and I love people who disagree. I probably spoke too long, but I was looking at the face of the president. But no, we can. I love Q&A. I just want to say I particularly love dissenting questions. I always love. I like to tell the story. I grew up in a very politically argumentative family. Extended family. I don't know how many of you did that, but I had a very, very dear uncle, and he and I spent about 35 years arguing politics together. The arguments were particularly tough in the Nixon years, and they got tough during the Clinton impeachment. There were certain moments I could always tell what the political mood was like by how loud Uncle Ray and I were at each other, you know. But his kids, bless them, my cousins and friends, asked me to do the eulogy at his funeral, and I made a point of quoting Nixon in my eulogy. And I did it partly because there was a Nixon line I actually liked about the man in the arena. He actually got it from Teddy Roosevelt. But also I did it, as I told the folks in the church, I said, you know, I just quoted Richard Nixon also because I thought if Uncle Ray had heard me quoting Richard Nixon, he'd come back to life and pop out of that casket just to tell me I knew you'd be quoting Nixon someday. So anyway, I welcome dissents as well as friendly questions, but whoever wants to, please.
Personality that's always left me a little dissatisfied.
My personality.
Yeah. You are.
Your ideas are fine. It's you I can't stand. You know. Yeah. Go ahead.
You are so calmly pessimistic, and it drives me crazy because it just seems to me like the world's falling apart. Both in what you've addressed tonight, you know, the powerful elite and globalization and all that. Plus, also this this standard of mediocrity that I see in the mass of Americans. Nobody's aspiring to greatness anymore, it seems like. And I want somebody like Jonah and Nineveh to scream and yell, "The end is it near?" And you're so calm and pessimistic. How do you reconcile that?
That's so. That is one of the most
calm and optimistic. I mean.
All right. Okay. Calm and optimistic.
And optimistic. I'm sorry. I totally misstated my whole thing.
Oh, that's okay. The.
I'm pessimistic. You're optimistic.
What I was going to answer by saying is that's not the critique I have heard is the one you actually intended to make. Somebody once called me a feliciopath, which I think means you see good things happening even when it's a real mess out there. Some of it, I mean, a couple of things. Some of these things I think are matters of character and how you end up approaching the world. Some of them, but you know, that Churchill quote that I use really does speak very much to what I think about us as Americans. I mean, look at our history and look at all the stuff we've done wrong and look at all the moments where we were really low. We had slavery from, 1607 to 1865. It took us a very long time. It took an absolutely vicious civil war that left 600,000 Americans dead in order to solve that. We went through, the Red Scare after World War II. We went through periods where people worked in sweatshops. I mean, we've had a lot of moments in our history where there were a lot of things going wrong. And I guess what I think is maybe there is a division of labor among those who are trying to bring about change. And there are the people who are called in their time to be Isaiah and Micah and Amos, to call down the criticism of the world on an unjust people or on a people doing unjust things. I also think there's a calling, and maybe that's, I think I really do mean that word, there's a calling for those who make a case that yes, but have hope. Yes, but don't lose heart. Yes, things are bad, but they can be better. I think it's what the Exodus story is about. One of my favorite books, Michael Walzer, the political philosopher, wrote a book called Exodus and Revolution. And he has this wonderful thing at the end of the book where he sort of postulates three things. And the first is, wherever you live, it's probably Egypt. In other words, things are all messed up. And then number two is, there's a promised land somewhere. And number three is the only way to get there is to stand together and march. And so I guess I see my role as talking more about points two and three than the first point that Walzer made. But it is an optimism. And the last thing is, I don't think You talk about, are we mediocrities at this moment? One of the reasons I don't like the deification of the founders is not that I don't really respect the founders. It's that I think we set up people in the past as if they are sainted figures without looking at their flaws, without looking at the ways in which they represented interests, just like our politicians do. Democratic politics uses the rough instruments of human beings to move forward. I mean, people said a lot of things about, you know, FDR. I think it was a Walter Lippmann quote that he was had a first-rate character and a second-rate mind. But he got us through a lot. So that's kind of who I am. It's what I see my role as. And I say bless you for being Isaiah, Micah, and Amos, because we need Isaiah, Micah, and Amos, too. Thank you. And that's by pulling you into it, I probably really infuriated you because I sort of tried to draw you into my happy little world. But yeah, thank you. We can talk after. You can berate me. Please, in the back.
Who should have much more to do and much more to think about? He certainly wasn't trying to sell books or anything. He has plenty of dough, from what I understand. So, why do you believe he just doesn't come across to me as someone that you would normally expect to be so obsessed? Even gotten to the president's grades and all sorts of things.
I try to explain as much as I can. I don't think I can begin to explain Donald Trump. I think Donald Trump was looking for a political following, which he appeared to find. He keeps getting invited back to these meetings. But, you know, our strange obsessions even led to jokes around the recent conclave that elected Pope Francis. I heard two excellent conclave jokes, which it's a Catholic university. They're respectful to our Catholic tradition, so I can tell them. The first was some of you who followed this noticed that one of the potential candidates, was Cardinal Turkson of Ghana. And I was told, I think it's a Mark Russell joke, that there was a vicious campaign aimed at preventing Cardinal Turkson from becoming pope. His opponents spread reports that he had actually been born in Hawaii. And how many John the 23rd Vatican II Catholics are there in this audience? Yeah, that's, so you will particularly get this one. Those of you who aren't from our tradition, we look at the 60s with John the 23rd in Vatican II is a very special time of reform in the church. So the joke I heard from a Jesuit, so it's repeatable, I think, at a Marianist university, is of God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit arguing about vacation plans. Jesus says to God the Father, why don't we go to the beach? And God the Father says, the beach. You know, when I invented the universe, I invented every grain of sand. And when I lie on the beach, it drives me crazy. I have to count every grain of sand. Let's not go to the beach. What about Jerusalem? And Jesus said, oh, Jerusalem. You know, I had a really, really rough time the last time I was in Jerusalem. It brings back some really, really tough memories. Let's not do that. How about Rome? And the Holy Spirit says, Rome, what a wonderful idea. I haven't been there since the 1960s. And so we all keep hoping. Maybe he returned to Rome last week. We are praying. So I'm sorry, I can't explain Donald Trump.
Well, after that presentation, I think I can answer the question of you are as dumb in person. but that's not very dumb at all. I want to remind the audience that Mr. Dion is going to do a book signing after the session here. And I want to leave him with a token of our appreciation from St. Mary's. And we appreciate your presentation. Thank you.